This is Karen Musgrave, and I'm conducting a Quilters SOS Save Our Stories interview with Penny Sisto. Penny is in Floyds Knobs, Indiana, and I'm in Naperville, Illinois, so we're conducting this interview over the telephone. Today's date is December 31st, 2009, and it's now 1:06 in the afternoon. And Penny, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to do this interview with me. Please tell me about your quilt, Queen Bee Colony Collapse.
All right. I found, I'm a thrift store antique store comber, as most quilters are, and I was combing through my favorite thrift store of all, which is Unique Thrift Store in Louisville, Kentucky. And it's in the West End, and you never know what you'll find. I found 200-year-old French lace there, and I found plastic shopping bags that I've cut apart and used on quilts. And I picked up about 36-inch square piece of, I guess it's an upholstery fabric, and I thought it just had random gold dots on it, but when I got it home and washed it, I realized they were bees. And that very morning, I had gotten an email from a friend of mine about her beehive colony collapsing and how heartbroken she was. And it seemed to me that the spirits had moved to put the bee fabric into my hand. So I visualized the queen bee and what she would have felt as the hum of the old ones and the working ones grew faint. And the first symbol that came into my mind was baldness. And so I made the queen bee figure in the middle of this quilt bald, as you would be if you had taken chemotherapy. Because whatever is poisoning our bees is also poisoning us. They are our new canary in the coal mine. And in the middle of the queen bee's forehead is a stencil in gold of a bee. In her breast, as you go down the quilt, I painted and then quilted giant bee figures. And in place where her hair would be, I was originally going to do white quilt thread. And then I realized, no, I wanted the quilt to take on a three-dimensional part. I often do that. So I made a little six-sided honeycomb up on the left of the quilt that almost looks like my grandmother's sewing basket. And out of it, I poured some honey. And the honey ran down and kind of gummed up. And by 3 days later, it had almost gone. So I thought, honey won't do it. And then I poured some beeswax, melted beeswax, and poured that out of the honeycomb. And that looked beautiful and smelled wonderful mixed with the honey. But as soon as I jostled and moved the fabric of the quilt, it cracked and sheared off. So then, because I love to invent new things, I warmed up some more beeswax, poured some honey into it, and poured some Gorilla Glue into it. And then molded that over my honeycomb cell, and it worked perfectly. It's about as strong as Gorilla Glue can get. Smells of beeswax. And where the Gorilla Glue's made little foam bubbles, there's honey trapped in them. So I got the best of all worlds. And because I got slap happy with the melted beeswax, I dribbled it down her bald head to make it look like hair. And I wish you could smell the quilt, because I'm a sniffer. I'm part bloodhound. And when you smell it, you can smell the honey vapors and the beeswax. So that, it's a very simple quilt.
Is this typical of your style?
You know, I like to do three-dimensional things from time to time. She, the queen bee herself, is typical of my style. The honey is not. I've used strange things in quilts before. The strangest being, I guess, human bone. And probably the second strangest. mouse mummies. I didn't kill the mice because I'm a pacifist. I don't even like killing bugs. But when I turned, I'm 68 now. When I turned 50, I have 7 kids for my body and 2 stepkids, and they tell me that I'm very difficult to get presents for because I don't like things very much. And my house is small, so I don't like possessions very much. But they found the ideal thing. They were up in the attic, and they found my old cottage urn, and in it these 3 mice had fallen and mummified, which is really sad, but fortuitous for me, because for my 50th birthday, they gave me the mummy mice. And I put them on a quilt about the nuclear time clock, how close we are to nuking each other. And it became a quilt that I called 3 Blind Mice. And I kept it quite a while for me. I kept it a few months before it sold.
Now, what are your plans for Queen Bee Colony Collapse?
Well, there's a Jewish community center gallery in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'll open a small show of about 17 quilts there in January. And I'm calling the show Survivors. And she'll go in the Survivor show.
So this quilt is 32 by 22. Is that a typical size for you?
Oh my, no. I do like to work large. The largest quilt I've made hangs in the Abbey of Gethsemane, where Thomas Merton, for those who know his writings, he wrote Seven Story Mountain and lots of other books. That was his monastery. And they have my largest, and I believe it's 28 foot long and about 22 foot wide. And it's a large risen Christ quilt. But my favorite size to do a quilt is about 5 foot by 4 foot.
Now, why is that your favorite size?
Because I can hold it up to myself. I don't measure things very much. That's why my quilts are always so wonky and off-center. But I can hold it up to my height plus a little bit, and that's a 5. It just suits my body size.
Well, tell me,
it feels comfy.
Tell me about your interest in quilt making.
I'm an accidental quilter in that my grandmother, who raised me, I'm obviously not from Kentucky, I'm from the Orkney Islands off the northernmost corner of Scotland. My granny reared me, and she made quilts for market, and once a month she would take little patchwork things into sell. And as soon as I grew old enough to wield a sewing needle, she would teach me 9 patch. And I would make that. But by age 7, I rebelled and began to incorporate dragons and my grandmother's face and seabirds and the old stories of the Celtics into the quilts. And at first she would wield a whip when I did it. And then she sold one or two and decided that was okay. And that's how I kind of fell into doing what I do now.
Tell me about your creative process.
Oh, that's a strange question for me, because I think, like a lot of artists, not just quilt artists, my eyes linger on things, on shadows, on tree bark. I'm looking out, I live in the middle of a woods, I'm looking out at the bark now, and I see figures in it and landscapes, and I rarely carry, I own a camera, but I rarely carry a camera, so I will write it into my mind, so that when I get home, I can put that face I saw, or that landscape I saw, down into fabric. I don't draw it first, because I'm I'm not very good at drawing. I just start cutting fabric.
So how many hours a week do you work on quilts?
I work 7 days a week. I give myself 2 weeks off every summer, and I don't take work with me to the ocean. I take all my kids and grandkids to the ocean for 2 weeks, and I just belong to them then. I don't work. I work 7 days a week, and I get up at 4:30, and I go to bed at about 10:30, and the whole time, if I'm not seeing to family affairs or animals or rehabbing or gardening or cooking, I'm sewing or dyeing fabric. It's pretty much all I do.
What does your family think of your quilt making?
When they were young, they thought they were weird and embarrassing. And now they're older, they still think a lot of them are weird, but I think they gradually, somewhere along about age 20, got proud of me. And several of them do art, but in different ways. My son John writes poems. Bethany makes clothing for children. My lawyer daughter embroiders. They each picked it up. Some of the boys make things out of steel. One boy is an actor. The art's brushed off onto them against their will. Yeah.
Is there any part of quilt making that you don't like? Any aspect?
The sneezing. The dust.
Mm-hmm.
The sneezing from pulling the batting. Yeah, that's the only bit. I really do love it all.
That's great.
I wouldn't love it if I had to measure and do straight lines, because I'm very bad at that. I do own a ruler somewhere, but it's probably bent by now.
Describe your studio to me.
Studio's too fancy a name for it. We live in a log cabin made out of cedar logs that I foolishly thought would keep moths out of my fabrics. The old ones would always say a cedar trunk will stop moths getting in your hosiery and your clothing, but we have moths every summer and spring. It's small. It's in the middle of a 400-acre woods. The studio simply is the room in it with the best light that I kind of stole. It started off to be a bedroom, and then I thought that was a waste of light. And gradually, I took it over like a hermit crab and called it my own. It's got a fairly high ceiling. Its light isn't very good, given that we're in the woods. And I have 4 fluorescent bulbs in it. When I turned 60, my son built shelves for it. Very simple. The floor is marble. It looks like a quilt made of marble scrap. Because on the Orkneys, everything's built out of stone. The floors, the window seats, the old croft, like the farmhouse I grew up in. My spirit aches for the rock of our houses. So Richard said, I'll make you a marble floor throughout the house. And then he priced marble, and we could afford about 2 square feet of it. So we drove home feeling sad, and then passed a place that makes vaults and funeral art for graveyards, and they had a huge scrap pile in the backyard, and we went and said, how much for your scrap pile? And he said, I'll pay you $300 to move.
Ooh.
Yeah. So it did all the floors in the house, and a friend's kitchen. It had a marble floor and a big work table, a huge long arm machine that's pretty old and ratchety now, and a fast sewing machine.
So do you use your long arm?
Yes, I love it. I used to do hand closing, but then I got old and I got greedy about time. So then I started machine quilting.
Have you ever used quilt making to get through a difficult time?
I think daily. Yeah, every day. Yeah, my gosh, yes. Especially as a child, because I grew up in a household that was very violent. It was a tiny little place, but in that tiny house with a grandfather, a great-grandmother, a grandmother, a great-uncle, an uncle, myself, and the cowman, Malcolm, who'd come to that farm as an orphan when he was 11. And the house would sit in our living room here. And it was a place of unspeakable horrors. And I would find places to sit and try to stitch away what was happening. Stitch it back together, I guess, I used to say.
Do you have any quilts from that time?
I do. I have the first one I ever made.
Oh, and what does it look like?
It looks like you don't have tinkers in America, but tinkers come to the islands every summer, and they're gypsy people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a gypsy man. Only I was 7 when I made it, so it's a child's view.
How big is it?
It's about 6 inches square. I could send you a scanner.
Oh, I would love to see it.
Yeah.
I would love to see it.
I got a whipping for it because I made his kilt out of my grandmother's kilt. I cut a piece out of that. And he has gold rings because the man had gold rings. And I cut those off a curtain. And she was not best pleased.
Mm.
And by when she died, they sent me a small shoebox of her belongings. And that was in it, wrapped around her teaspoon. So I have them all, the spoons and the quilt. I remember when I had finished it, she came in from milking the cow. And I said, I have made thee a real quilt, and brought it out. Oh, my. I thought she'd kill me.
Mm.
She was very angry. But she obviously sent something because apparently she kept it.
Right.
And she died old, even older than me.
So why is quilt making important to you?
I think it's important because women through the ages have had little or no accolades heaped on them for their artistic insight. So we have made our art, our children, enriching our children, beautifying our homes, growing our food, cooking our food, stitching our garments. And women are walking art to me. Their dreams, their voices, their eyes, their hands. And this was one area we could claim. This was our area. And so the early ones are of woman's things, lovers' knots, graveyards, gardens, steps, windows. And I just see it as something that in the world I lived in, when my character was forming, I could own. And I could pull that needle the same way women had pulled bone needles from the first time women made art. It linked me. It gave me an anchor. It gave me a thread to clutch.
Literally.
Gave me a thread.
How do you want to be remembered?
No, not personally, no. That's a funny thing that you said that, because the last sweat lodge I was in with three of my daughters, one of the things, concerns that people were talking about was fame, because the son was going through a bad reaction to his fame. And one of the daughters turned across the sweat lodge towards me. I always sit in the north, facing the north, so I sit in what we call the north on the circle. And she said, "He must learn to be like Mama and want to be forgotten." So that's how I feel. I want to leave no trace whatsoever.
Not even with your quilts?
No. And the nice thing about quartz is they decay. It's not like rock or metal. It will fall back into dust.
And probably make someone sneeze, right?
Yes. Yes. That's a good memory. Sneeze memory.
Tell me about the movies you've been involved in.
Sorry?
The movies? I know you've had some movies done of you.
Oh, yes, yeah. Actually, videos, yes.
Videos.
One was a young Indiana woman called Caroline Nellis, and she had come to, I think, gallery talk. I'm a reluctant talker, but whenever I have shows, they usually ask me to give a gallery talk, and so I do a real easy way. I just walk from quote to quote and tell the stories that arise out of them. And she heard it and said that she would like to film it, and she had never made a film before, and she came with a man who had done sound on some films before, and they spent, I think, 4 days here. She just kind of kept me pinned down on a chair and asked questions, and it was it was nerve-wracking at first, and then you kind of forget that she's there, and just because I often talk to myself when I'm working anyway, so it just became like that after a while.
And what was the response to the video?
Well, you know, she won a couple of things with it in film. I'm not sure what they call them. Competitions, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Gatherings. She won some awards with that. And then she got some notoriety points from it, too, and was able to make other stuff. And the second one that was done by the Women's Study Group at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, because I'd been there a few years in a row to do a show of quilts, and made friends with a young Native American woman there who was the gallery director called Kay Hawley. And she and Lynn, and Lynn's daughter, who funnily enough went on to work on a show called Judge Judy, made a lot of money producing that, or assistant producer for that. But her first, she wet her wings on that. I even forget what they called it. I got a copy of it somewhere. The first one was called Woman of the Cloth. And I think they just called it Penny Sister Fabric Artist. And they won some awards, too, with that. In fact, we showed it in Madison Square Garden years ago. Because I went there. They paid me an airfare and a hotel room to go there. And I went to New York City, and it was pouring down rain. And I was standing outside of Madison Square Gardens, because it was a place I'd heard of there was no garden, it's just this big ugly building, but they had a big notice board outside all done in fluorescent lamps that kept switching and flickering, and then up on the screen came Penny Sisto, fabric artist, now showing, they named the place inside, but it was showing, and I was so excited for some reason, and so I said, hey, there was a guy passing by, look, that's me, like that. But it was a homeless man, so I don't think he even believed me. So he just wandered on, and I was left in the rain. That's funny.
Do you think of yourself more as an artist or a quilt maker, or do you even make the distinction?
Well, my husband makes a distinction. He gets pissed off whenever I say I'm a quilter. I'm an old lady who lives in the woods and makes quilts. He says, should be artists, and that they're not quilts, but a quilt, by my definition, is a front, a back, and some batting in the middle, and I kind of stretch that definition, because one time I wanted to make a quilt about peeping toms, and the way in which men are enchanted by and repelled by women's bodies. So I made the back of it gauze and the front of it gauze, which I had starched by painting layers and layers of glue on it. And then out of that I constructed boxes so that it became lots of little boxes. And onto them I sewed tiny little mirrors so that when you looked at it, if you got too close, you only saw your own peeping Tom eye looking back at you. But if you stood back from it, you could see all the way through the quilt. And for the batting, I used women's pubic hair. And I went to the local quilt group that would let me in those days. and I took a lot of little envelopes with me and a big pair of scissors. And they all said, hey, Penny, what are you working on? And I said, girls, do I have a quilt for you? I need some volunteers.
How many did you get?
I only got four. So all my daughters got scalps, and I got scalps, and my husband got scalped too, so I sneaked in some mail there. Yeah, and it was very meager. In my mind, the boxes were going to be stuffed, but they were actually strands rather than stuffing of pubic hair. I don't know how I got away onto that sidetrack, but see, yeah, a quilt. Is it art or is it just a quilt? It's up to us, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So do you still belong to the quilt group?
Nope. No. I'm just not through their fault. I'm just not a good belonger. I never developed that habit. I think that's a habit you have to have the security to own when you're very young and developing. No. I even in the middle of our family gathering here over Christmas, there were 38 of us, plus some friends, and even there, where it should be the most belonging, I simply do not belong. And it's not a sad thing. I'm not sitting here touching my thumb. It's not a sad thing. I just never developed that habit.
What advice would you offer someone starting out?
Starting off quilting?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. I would say learn all the rules of sewing and quilting and then throw them all away. Because you need enough confidence to take steps into the unknown with your needles and thread. So learn everything that will give you that safety net, the illusion of knowing what you're doing. And and then throw all those rules away. And don't listen to people when they classify you as this, that, or the other. After the end of the Vietnam War, I made altogether approximately 41 quilts about Vietnam because it impacted my generation. So all through the part of that war that I was familiar with, I peace marched and got arrested a couple of times for it, but that was the side I came down on. After the war had ended and the real damage to America began, the alienation, the post-traumatic stress, the injuries to the inside of the people on both sides of the question, I decided that I had to pick up the responsibility for any verbal violence I had directed in my thoughts and in my chants towards these wounded warriors who had come back. So I began going to Vietnam vet centers, and as each quilt was finished, I would take it to the center to share it with the vets. And ultimately, I gave them away to Vietnam vets. Well, on about quilt 15, which was huge, it's about 10 foot by 12 foot, and on it, it shows what at first glance looks like a flock of birds, but turns out to be helicopters. And what looks like a flower garden in the foreground turns out, when you walk closer to the quilt, to be a soldier eviscerated, his guts made of bright red satin, so spilling over. The library in Bardstown, Kentucky had said, we're having a local quilt show. Anyone with a newly finished quilt, please bring it by and we'll have us a little show and hang them all in the library. And so in I marched, taking them at their word with my latest Vietnam vet quilt. And they were horrified. One lady cried. They escorted me and my skanky quilt out. I was told it wasn't a quilt, it was pornography. And
oh, my.
I wanted just to go home and kind of hide, but I decided that I owed the people on both sides of that war more than that, so I spread it out over the library stone steps, and I just sat there. And if you wanted to go into the library that day or two that I sat there, you had to walk over my quilt to do it. And eventually the local paper took a picture of it, and then some Vietnam vets came, and you know, they stood on a guard while that quilt was there in their raggedy old uniforms. It was
Wow. Extraordinarily
moving.
It brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah. And when, you know, my little revolt was done, I gave their local center the quilt.
Have you been back to see them at all?
Yes, yeah. I'm good friends with a lot of them. Yeah.
So what did the little library group, what did they think of your protest?
Well, after a while, it was, I guess it's kind of like the transition that happened in my own kids. After a while, that little town before we moved kind of got a little bit proud of me. And my husband, who's a jazz musician, so instead of being the weirdo dairy farmers with all the kids who are, you know, a blemish, we became sort of, they liked us a little better. And now we get asked back there and
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they got used to it. Well, with artists a lot, sometimes the world catches up, sometimes it doesn't.
What do you think makes a quilt artistically powerful?
I think if the woman, or sometimes the man, who makes it has enough spiritual energy spilling through her fingers to convey to the onlooker what she or he is feeling when they make it. It can be a single square that takes your breath from you and takes you to that same place she was at.
Whose works are you drawn to and why?
In art or in quilting?
Or you can do both.
I think Van Gogh because I like people with flaws. They give you room to get inside them. People whose work is perfect is intriguing, but there's no room for you inside it. There's no opening for you, for your input. I think he would be the person in art I'm most drawn to. There are quilters I love because I love them. Probably nothing that you'd want said, but I try never to look at other people's work in my own field. I mean, sometimes I do, but sometimes people ask me to judge something. Or fellow other women stitchers and quilters who I love will come over and we'll laugh together and work together. Or I used to give workshops. Most of the things I look at in my everyday life are living things. Trees, I do a lot with animals and birds. For some reason they like me and come really close. I walk a lot.
Tell me about your workshops.
Well, I have not... Well, I was going to say I haven't given any for years because I'm pretty bad, I would imagine, as a teacher. They used to pay me a lot of money to do them, for us a lot of money because we're pretty poor. They would take me to, there was a place in Pacific Grove, and I did workshops, I think 3 or 4 years in a row there. I would go there and have ladies pick from a pile of what I call magic items that I would have brought, an old rosary, a pebble, a skeletonized leaf, bird feathers, an owl's beak. I would just throw them on the table and ask them to pick the one that spoke closest to them. And then they pick that up and tell you the story about it. And then I would say, they would think they're going to make their first piece of art about that, and I would say, turn to the woman on your right and give it to her as a gift. And then they'd have to make the art about what the woman on the left had given. Yeah. And then I would take them step by step how to portray perhaps the face of an icon that came into their mind, a medicine spirit being. And the kind of women I would get in my class would be, number one, people drawn to pictures of my work that they'd seen, and number two, people who the workshop they wanted was overcrowded, so mine had the least people in it, so I got the eldest one. And sometimes it would be someone who'd come on a dare to themselves, saying, there are things in my past I never want to face, and I thought your workshop would force me to get them.
Mm.
So we'd be a Markley crew.
That's a big responsibility for you.
Yes. But the same as being in a TP healing circle or in a sweat lodge, running a sweat lodge. Same thing. It's all the same. We're all survivors, right?
Mm-hmm. I do believe that. Is there anything that you would like to share that we haven't touched upon?
No, only yes. I mean, why did I say no then start a sentence? Yes. It's so rewarding to me to know that where I picked up my needle from the bone needles of those long gone, young women like one of my granddaughters, Annie, who's now 4, has picked up a needle and spilled her own blood with it and said, Granny, I want to sew with a needle even though it hurts me. And something happened during the course of my lifetime where women have again begun to own their own stories and own their own tools. And whereas when I was very young, art seemed to be for men. I think the fastest, most liveliest, most passionate artists that I know today are sewing women.
Well, thank you for taking time out of your day to
share
with me.
Oh, you also. Yes.
You are wonderful.
Yeah, and may you see the moon tonight. I know I'll be
looking. Oh, I hope I see the blue moon tonight, too. And I want to thank you, because you're our last interview for 2009.
Oh, my goodness me. Going out with a fizzle.
No, going out with a bang. When do you mean a fizzle? We're going out with a bang. You are very wonderful. So
thank you, my love.
We're going to conclude our Quilters SOS Save Our Stories interview at 1:49.